Welcome everyone that's listening online and watching the streaming presentation as well. We're to continue our consideration and study around the seals that are in Revelation. And as you can see from the overhead, tonight we're going to be considering the sixth seal. And Brother Gary has asked that we read together as an introduction to his remarks from Revelation chapter 6. So that's a very dramatic chapter in Revelation chapter 6. That's a great introduction for our Brother Gary's remarks tonight on the sixth seal. Thank you.
Thanks, Brother Joe, and good evening, everyone. Oh, thank you. We have got an audience. That's good. Excellent. So thanks for having me back. You know, as I was rushing down to get here on time, so sorry again, I kind of was reflecting with Naomi that the last time we were rushing down to get here on time, it was all dark. And so it's around about almost 6 months, actually, since we were looking at the Revelation chapter 6 and the six seals. And so what I thought we'd do is we just have a very brief recap, right? So if you've missed the previous classes, get ready for a whirlwind. As it was read to us tonight, the first four seals are encapsulated in four horsemen, all right? And we mentioned during the classes that there's some artistic license being taken in that, and it's not entirely correct, all right? But what we said of the four horsemen was that the horse was the Roman Empire. So this is the domain of where these events are happening. The color of the horse is the condition of the empire. And the rider of the horse, so the various actors, and they're using props to demonstrate the focal and using them in fulfilling the focal point of the scene that they are playing out in Revelation chapter 6. And we're not going to go through all of these in any detail, but Revelation 6 verse 2 was the first seal, and we established that was from AD 96 to 180. And it was shortly after John. The horse was a peaceful empire because it was a white horse, although there was a persecution of Christians. But that resulted in a very effective gospel proclamation effort because the bow without the arrows was proclaiming the word of God and giving hope of eternal life to those riders who overcame. The second seal was quite dramatic, a really dramatic turn of events, right? The seal from 180 to 211. And that was a time when the peace that was viewed as the golden age of the Roman Empire to that time and all through history, actually, was taken away, and there was bloodshed all over the place. There was an extreme amount, and that were the weapon of choice told to us. Remember in verse 4 that it was given unto him a great itty-bitty sword, right? So it's a contradiction because it's a great sword, but it's not a sword, it's an assassin's dagger. And so a lot of assassinations that went on. There was a great quantity of bloodshed, so peace was just removed. And then we came to the third seal, which went from 211 to 235. So it's not great slabs of years going by. They're relatively short in these, right? So, and the seal it was the black horse, all right? So, and that's in, where are we, verse 5, I beheld a black horse, and this was a time of mourning. So remember, we refer to people how that they are in black when they mourn. And again, more death. Right, so particularly during the reign of Caracalla and Elagabalus. So Caracalla, where he went and just wreaked vengeance across the nobility of Rome. And so it was just a very dangerous time. And there was extortion, incredibly, of taxes, an incredible extortion of taxes. So that it actually became uneconomic for farmers to farm food to sell because they would go backwards economically. It would cost them more in taxes than they'd raise, than they'd get from selling the grain. And so there was a lot of starvation and a lot of food shortages. But right towards the end of this third seal, there was some fiscal restraint that was introduced. And then we came to the fourth seal. Right, the fourth seal. And this was pale, the pale horse. And it was pale like a deathly hue. Right, so it's chloris. It's just that green pallor just before death. Interestingly, we're going to come across chloris in a moment as well, but in a different context. All right, so there's a lot of attention to the geography, and there are a whole range of different means of death. And so there's another sword that is used here. All right, another sword. It's in verse 8, to kill with a sword. And that sword, we established, was a different type of sword. It was a rompheia. It was a long Thracian sword, and that referred particularly to an emperor whose name, can anybody remember? Okay, good. I can't either. No, it'll come to me. Hang on. Maximinus Thrax, that's who it was, because he thraxed everybody. He thrashed everybody. Right? So Maximinus Thrax, who was a who was from this area of Thrace, and a giant of a man. And you know, he was always put down by Romans because he wasn't of Roman birth. And so when he became emperor, he just went to town. And so there was famine, there was death, there were people put under the sword and under beasts, and it was just an awful time. But in a particular part of the Roman Empire. And then we came to, and the level of death extended across the entire society. And so even with the emperors of the fourth seal, so remember where we had those screeds and screeds of emperors, and every single one died, murdered, committed suicide, struck by lightning. And so in terms of statistics, 27 emperors over the seal. One of them is alive, Diocletian, and he features very heavily in the fifth seal. Diocletian's alive, but 16 by murder, 1 by suicide, 5 killed in battle, 3 by plague or illness, 1 struck by lightning, natural causes, 0. All right, so death really was, in this pale horse, was pervasive. And so we found that there was a pattern, which is on the screen, that there was an attribute around a color. There was various attributes. There was a color. There were certain props that were used. There were things that they were doing, and there were some other things that happened, and there's a time frame. So it goes very consistent. And so we could apply the same logic and apply it to history. And what certainly impressed me, and hopefully impressed you all as well, was the incredible level of detail that is contained in very few words, and how that it came to pass exactly as Scripture had foretold. And then we came to the fifth seal, the souls under the altar. So we did actually cover this last time, but what we neglected to cover, because it wasn't relevant to the fifth seal itself, is certain of the historical nuances that happened, which actually tell us or give more context around what happens in the fifth seal. So our plan for tonight is to do a refresh of the fifth seal. Now, it's not going to be in as much detail as last time. All right, we're going to focus more on the historical events, and then we're going to move on to the sixth seal. Now, the sixth seal itself, we're actually going to take, because I think we've got three classes, we're actually going to take a fair chunk of this class and all of next class to go through it. The sixth seal is the longest seal in Revelation chapter 6. And so remarkable are the events which we'll be considering, and God does not waste real estate in the Scriptures. All right, when things are repeated or told in a different way, it's because they are really, really important. So important are the events of the sixth seal that a whole other chapter is devoted to it in Revelation chapter 12. It's the same event, but told in a different context, and for a very good reason as well. So it's well worth our consideration. So the fifth seal, the souls under the altar. Okay, so we had established last time what we were looking to see. All right, so we were looking to see a change in ecclesial unity, and so how we described that last time was that there started to be false doctrine coming in, Right, so the initial inklings of heaven going, a little bit of dodginess around the nature of God, not so much as we will be seeing probably next week, God willing. Right, but lack of ecclesial unity. We saw that there's absolute persecution, or what we'd be looking for, and we will mention this, what we'd be looking for was persecution of true believers who kept their beliefs. All right, so persecution of true believers who kept their beliefs. There's an altar there. Okay, so, and let's just read that. And when in verse 9 of Revelation chapter 6, when he had opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? All right, so that altar we established last time, but we remind ourselves that altar is specifically the altar of burnt offering, where the blood would run down on the altar. And so you've got this picture, this really dramatic and actually quite awful picture because of what actually happened. This awful picture of true saints whose souls are under the altar. And so that spoke of the death of the saints. And they're praying, how long, O Lord? And that word Lord, we said, is different to the normal word, Greek word used for Lord. It's the Greek word Dominus. And that, we haven't got in the slides, but we'll mention, that is a title which Diocletian specifically assumed to himself. And it was the first time that that title was assumed by an emperor. And so it was this, there was a choice that was being put before brothers and sisters. You can either follow the true Lord, the God of heaven, or follow somebody who is calling themselves Lord but is not. And we'll see how that works out as we go through. There's an earnest cry for revenge. Okay, they cried with a loud voice, saying in verse 10, how long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? Well, that time was soon to come. Okay, it was soon to come. And so that earnest cry, but ultimately, they would be given white robes because they endured to the end. And white robes in verse 11 were given unto every one of them, and it was said unto them that they should rest yet a little season until their fellow servants also and their brethren that should be killed as they were should be fulfilled. And so there's just a little season. This seal is just going to be a little season. All right, and there it is. 303 to 311. It's a period of 8 years. It's from him. It's the shortest seal. Okay, a short seal, but a dreadful, dreadful time where you've actually got those who have been slain crying out for vengeance and saying that you need to wait just a little longer until more are going to be killed. So a really dreadful time. So what happened in the fifth seal? So this is where we got up to in the fourth seal. We got up to those particular emperors and one remaining, Diocletian. Right, and Diocletian is the key to the fifth seal. Right, so here's the key. So he had a very humble background, as got on the slide. He was a cavalry commander in one of the previous emperor's armies, and he excelled. And he was appointed as emperor after Carus's death, as it says on the screen. His wife and his daughter are thought to be Christian. Right? They're thought to have been Christian. So in the early parts of his reign, he's actually reasonably well disposed to Christians in the early part of his reign. But it doesn't last for long. But what he recognizes is the great challenge of being a Roman emperor. In other words, and if you have a look at what we saw in the previous slide, in terms of the statistics, you didn't stay an emperor long, all right? So something happened along the way. And so what he thought of was, what is a way that we can actually make this a logical and peaceful transition? Because you can imagine as one emperor went and got rid of another one, or as a Praetorian Guard, remember we spoke about the Praetorian Guard and how they would go and sell themselves to the highest bidder and put that person as emperor, and then when that person didn't deliver all the money that they promised and could never deliver, the Praetorian Guard, who were meant to be the secret service and protect the emperor, would go and kill them. And so he recognizes the challenges of the previous emperors. And so what he wants to do is he wants to introduce something that is quite a remarkable reform in the way in which Rome is governed. And so he introduces the Tetrarchy. And so the Tetrarchy, or the fifth seal, what the idea was is that Diocletian was going to be the emperor. And he decided that he was going to be the emperor in the eastern region of the empire. Okay, and so he divided the empire into two areas, east and west. And it was actually subdivided into, east was divided into two parts, and the west was divided into two parts as well. All right, so, and he divided that into that, and he called himself an Augustus. All right, so he appoints him as a Caesar and then as an Augustus. And so in the western part of the empire, he appoints gentleman, Maximian. And the general idea is that you've got the Augusti up at the top, so they are the big cheeses, and then you've got the not-so-big cheeses underneath them, who are the Caesars. All right, so I'm sure Julius Caesar would have turned in his grave if he knew that a Caesar had been downgraded. But be that as it may, so you've got Augustus up at the top, and you've got Caesars up the, down the bottom. And so for Diocletian in the eastern part, half of the empire, Galerius is appointed as the Caesar. And then in the western part is Constantius the First. He's actually known as Constantius Chlorus, as well by his troops, because he had a very pale complexion. Right now, we refer to Chlorus in the pale horse being the sickly hue of death, so hopefully he looked healthier than that. But he evidently had a pale complexion, but he was actually a very athletic and a very good leader, and rose up to prominence. And he is the father of Constantine the First. All right, so the idea is that from a succession planning perspective, and so succession planning for those of us who work in business and you know the whole concept of succession planning, what happens when somebody important passes off the scene for some reason or another, just retires or which is never a good thing to do when you're up against time. When I was running workshops on this and looking at succession planning, the standard fare used to be, what happens if that person gets hit by a bus? All right, so if you get hit by a bus and that became unfashionable, so what happens if they win cross lotto? That's the newer one, but just remember, for those who are tempted, cross lotto is a tax for those who don't understand statistics and probability. There's some succession planning that is put in here, and the idea is that Diocletian and Maximian will one day go and vacate the role of Augusti, and those below, Constantius and Galerius, will go then and assume that role. Okay, that's the theory. That's what's meant to happen, and that's the Tetrarchy. And just to go and keep things, it all sounds very happy and things like that, but just to go and make sure that things go as they should, Constantius goes and divorces his wife Helena, and he goes and marries the daughter of Maximian, Theodora, to go and make sure that he's kept in line. Okay, so there's still a little bit of, let's make sure that people are singing from our particular music sheet. So why is that important? Well, Helena is the mother of Constantine. And what happens to Helena to go and exert further pressure to make sure that Constantius behaves himself is Helena and her son Constantine are sent off, and he's fairly young at this stage. They are sent off to go and live in Nicomedia, which is the throne and the palace of Diocletian. Diocletian, who goes and likes to go and get people murdered and all of that. So you can imagine the father figure that Constantine had. All right, so that's how the tetrarchy is meant to work in theory. All right, but we've got Constantine sitting off to the side of Diocletian there, and he is being trained up and no doubt expecting great things. All right, so in terms of the fourth part of the earth, there are four parts in the empire, and we've got Diocletian here in the east, we've got Maximian in the around Italy and that part, we've got Galerius in the central part, so in round about Greece, so Diocletian in today Turkey, Galerius round about Greece and that part, Maximian in Italy and up into France and that a little bit, and Spain and North Africa. Actually, he's not in France, he's in Spain and North Africa. And then lastly, Constantius in England, and he's actually in York. All right, so that's where he's got his capital. And so the Tetrarchy actually introduced some level of stability, at least for a little bit, to the Roman Empire. And so this is celebrated in a statue that's in Venice. Okay, that's a statue in it's not as old as the Tetrarchy, obviously. I think it's in medieval times rather than early on. So a time of relative stability for a short while. Okay, so that's something which is quite useful for the empire. All right, but then, as we mentioned last time, so in Nicomedia, Galerius comes to visit Diocletian, and Diocletian is really worried about what's going on in the empire, and things aren't going his way, and who could be blamed? And so Galerius, being the faithful pagan that he was, goes and says, right, let's go off to the temple of the gods, and they go off to the temple, and a sacrifice is offered. Entrails out. Let's go and have a look at the entrails. And, I can't actually see what's going on. We think it's... I can't actually get a clear vision. And Galerius says, why aren't you getting a clear vision? Could it be the Christians? And the... If you've got your job on the line, because Diocletian is right there, right, give me something else, like Nebuchadnezzar, off with your head. Either my head or the Christians. So he says, yes, it must be the Christians. So that's right up Galerius's alley, who really does not like the Christians. And so in a series of four edicts in 303, in 2 and 303, or 3 and 303, in 1 and 304, there's an increasing level of persecution put on Christians. Okay, the whole scene is opened by burning down a Christian church that could have held, it's estimated, up to 5,000 people. All right, there is a little bit of, under the third edict, there's a general amnesty, provided people go and sacrifice to the gods. And so that's why we've got two classes in Revelation chapter 6 and at verse 11, where we've got their fellow servants and their brethren. So there are those who are truly servants, and there are those who say they are. And there were Christians who went and said, well, better to go and say something to the pagan gods than to lose my head. But then in the fourth edict, there is just... The hammer's really put down. And so a terrible, terrible time for our brothers and sisters. A terrible time for our brothers and sisters. And so the prophecy is very precise. And so what happens with the Tetrarchy? Well, Diocletian starts to get ill. And so he disappears for quite some time, and he comes out of his temple and says in round about 305, right, so we're going to do, I'm going to do what nobody else has ever done. I'm actually going to abdicate. I'm going to resign. All right, and what's more, my mate Maximian is going to resign as well. And so they step away, and the tetrarchy falls into place. The mechanism falls into place. And so Constantius the First becomes Augustus, and Galerius, so that's Augustus in the west, and Galerius becomes Augustus in the east. But let's not forget that waiting in the wings there is Constantine. By this stage, he's been out in battle. The troops love him. He's respected. He's calm. He's diligent. He's actually, really somebody of quite eminence in the Eastern Empire. So you can imagine what's going through his mind about what happens next. Because now what happens is that they need to go and appoint their new Caesars. And so there's a really fascinating book that's where this quote comes from that was given to me by somebody in this room, actually, so thanks very much for that. It's called The Ghost Empire, and it's a very easy read. And this is what it has to say about the selection of the new Caesars, and it's quite dramatic. The gaze of all was upon Constantine. No one had any doubts, and he's quoting here from a Roman historian, Lactantius. No one had any doubts. The soldiers who were present were delighted with him, Constantine. They wanted him. They were making prayers for him. Then suddenly, Diocletian proclaimed Severus in the west and Maximinus Dea as Caesars. Just so happens that Maximinus Dea is the nephew of Galerius. So everyone is thunderstruck. Constantine was standing on the platform and the people hesitated, wondering whether his name had been changed. But then, in full view of everybody, Galerius stretched out back his hand and drew Maximinus Dea out of from behind him, pushing Constantine away. So, a very dramatic turn of events and very, very unexpected. So, what happens is Flavius Severus is appointed in the western region. Constantine is spurned, and the nephew, Maximinus Dea, is appointed as the new Caesars. So what do you think is going through Constantine's mind? He'd be seeing himself as a threat to the new Caesar and the new Augustus. And he knows that he can get sanctuary if he goes across to his father. And so, you know, to use a phrase from the United States from the 1800s, head west, young man. All right? So now, Galerius wants to keep him under control. And so the only way to keep him under control is to keep him close by, you know, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. But on one particular night, he goes and gets Galerius quite inebriated, and he goes and manages to get a permission to go and leave. And so he hops on a horse, and he hightails it out of there. He just goes and goes and goes. And there are all these houses where they go and get, you know, pick up fresh horses. And by the time he gets to the first house, the horse is absolutely exhausted. He gets another one. Before he heads off, he lames all the other horses, heads to the next one, gets another horse, lames all the horses, keeps on going, keeps on going, keeps on going, so that nobody can follow him. And he ends up in York with his father. And there's actually a statue of Constantine in York. Right, so, but it gets more interesting because Constantius dies. All right, so he goes to 306 and he dies. And in theory, what should happen is that Flavius Severus should be proclaimed the Augustus, and then he should select a new Caesar. All right, that in theory is what should happen. But he's put up there, and it starts getting a bit messy because the troops in And Flavius Severus, remember, Constantius is in England. Flavius Severus is over Italy and North Africa. All right, so they're not in the same backyard. They're quite some way away. So he's appointed, but the troops of Constantius, who have allegiance to Constantine, reckon, well, actually, he has a better man. And so the troops go and appoint Constantine as Augustus. And so Augustus, Constantine, now goes and sends a letter to Galerius saying, well, this is what happened, and he sends him almost like a picture. You know, these days we take a selfie. They didn't have iPhones in those days. But sends him a picture of him in purple in the royal robes. So Galerius is furious. He's fuming because this is not what he wanted. But he knows that he's got to be careful here because he doesn't want to upset Constantine, because he knows that Constantine is actually a really skilled soldier. So he writes back and says, okay, what you can do is you're not going to be Augustus, you're going to be Caesar. All right, and Constantine accepts that because at least ostensibly he accepts that, not really, but he says thank you very much because he now has the seal of approval of Galerius that he is now a ruler in the Roman Empire. Okay, and remember, he's in York. All right, so, but then what happens is Maxentius, who is actually the related, I think he's a son of Maximian, who, remember, with Diocletian, were the first, gets a bit confusing, I know, were the first Augusti. He's also annoyed because, well, he was snubbed. Surely he should have got his dad's old job. And so he goes and makes a play for being Caesar. And even more, when Severus decides to go and see if he can go and get some land further to the right-hand side from the east, and he is actually forced to commit suicide by Maximinus Dea, when that doesn't go too well. And so he dies. And so Maxentius decides he's going to make a play to be the Augustus. And so now we've got these two very strong characters, Constantine and Maxentius, who are both saying that they the main rulers of the western part of the empire. As the ad goes, but wait, there's more. Not just yet, though. So hold that thought. All right, so, but where we're getting to is that there's the tetrarchy, which in theory could have been quite successful and was successful, certainly in its first iteration. In the subsequent iterations, when human behavior got involved, became worse and worse and worse. And then with all of this, while all this is going on, in the eastern half of the empire in particular, there is still a lot of persecution of the Christians. Not so much in the western part, in particular under Constantius and then Constantine, because they were more disposed to Christians and they didn't agree with what was going on. But what happens is around this time, towards the end of the fifth seal, Galerius himself, who was actually the not necessarily the architect, but certainly the instigator with Diocletian of the terrible persecution, he gets gravely ill. Right? He actually has a what's believed to be a necrotizing bowel cancer. So it is very ugly, and not to put too fine a point on it, it is very smelly. And it is agonizing, right? So here is the ruler of the empire who is basically dying. And he issues in 311 this edict of toleration. We're not going to go through it, but basically the ones I wanted to highlight was this one over here, the second last one. Considering the observation of our own mild clemency and eternal custom by which we are accustomed to grant clemency. And so he's going, oh, well, we're not so bad. We're giving clemency. So we're just being mild. Never mind that with the souls being burnt under the altar, one of the ways of putting to death was by slow roasting over fire. It was a very apt description when the seal talks about an altar of burnt offering. They were literally burnt, our brothers and sisters. And he now grants clemency. And what's more, he goes and says, consequently, in the last yellow section, in accord with our indulgence, they ought to pray to their God for our health and the safety of the state, so that the state may be kept safe on all sides and they may be able to live safely and securely in their own homes. So here's this person that is dying of this horrific disease. And he's actually asking those who he persecuted to pray for him. And so there's almost like the revenge which the those under the altar are praying for starts to take effect towards the end of the fifth seal, when Galerius himself dies in agony with a dreadful disease and he passes off the scene. But the real revenge is going to happen in this sixth seal. Right, but once again, we cannot help but be impressed with the accuracy at which things are portrayed. How that even down to the way in which people were put to death is reflected, and terribly so, but it's reflected in the meanings of what was going on. How that there was a Lord, a true Lord that you could serve, or this false Lord who was actually saying, serve other gods. Right? How that, you know, the whole thing, and how that this cry for, this anguish cry for revenge was not yet answered, but the time was going to come. And so we come to the sixth seal, the great earthquake. All right, so just everybody who haven't looked at that, just have a look at that picture. It's actually really well done. Okay, and actually paints the picture. Sorry, it is a painting, but paints the story very, very well. All right, so let's just read the sixth seal. I beheld in verse 12, when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake. And the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood. And the stars of heaven fell unto the earth, even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs when she is shaken of a mighty wind. And the heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. And the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the rich men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bondman and every free man, hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us, and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? So just as we read that, did any Bible echoes pop up in anybody's head of chapters elsewhere? Sorry? Isaiah. Right? The rocks, and the other saying to the rocks fall upon us. And so there's actually quite a few, and we're not going to deal with it this time, we'll deal with it next time, but there's quite a few references to the Old Testament. A sneak peek into next week, sorry, 2 weeks' time, those references all refer to the return of the Lord Jesus Christ. Okay? And there's a reason for that, which we'll come across next week. Jesus is obviously not going to return at this time, but there's something which is quite remarkable about what happens in this seal. All right, so what we've got, and we're not going to go as we've done previously, we're going to split the analysis of these verses and put some history in the middle. Right, so what we've got is a great earthquake. So it's not just an earthquake, it's a great earthquake. Does anybody know how many earthquakes there are in Revelation? Sorry, let me rephrase it. Does anybody know how many great earthquakes there are in Revelation? Two plus one. There's three. There's three great earthquakes. One over here. All right, but it's speaking about a great upheaval. And so it's a great upheaval. There are three great earthquakes in Revelation. So one over here, which is Constantine in chapter 6 of verse 12. And we won't prove this tonight, but take my word for it, and maybe in later classes somebody can do that for you. There's one in chapter 11 and verse 13, and that's the French Revolution. And the last one is in chapter 16 at verse 18, and that's the return of the Lord Jesus Christ. So why are there three great earthquakes? And they are signposts in the book of Revelation about things changing. It's a great upheaval. Something monumental is happening. And so out of everything that has happened in these seals, this is the one that there's this great earthquake. So just a why are there these great earthquakes? So just a throwback to the class one. So we put up a slide which said the deadly contest of Revelation. So we've got the godly versus the ungodly. We've got the lamb versus the great beast. We've got the bride of Jesus versus a great whore. We've got virgins versus those who committed fornication. We've got those who identify with Mount Zion, where you've got those who identify with the seven hills. You've got Jerusalem versus spiritual Babylon. You've got those who are persecuted through history and those who are doing the persecution and who are drunk with the blood of the saints. They are saved by Jesus on the one side and they are destroyed by Jesus on the other. So you've got right the way through the book of Revelation. We've got this great contest of life and death, which is why it's so important that we make sure we understand who these players are, because we don't want to be on the wrong side. And so if we have a look at those three great earthquakes, what do we have? It's a very simple thing to follow. What we've got is paganism, in summary, and we'll see this in more detail by the end of what we're doing. Paganism is replaced by the church, by Christianity. What do you have in the French Revolution? Well, what happens is the power of the church is reduced. And so there's a great shock because the whole social structure is changed. Where you had the nobility and the clergy and the laity, right, with the commoners, they now found a voice. And the power of the nobility, actually their power was taken off from their heads literally at the guillotine. And the church lost a lot of power in that time, so it was no longer the force that it was in previous centuries. And then you've got the return of Jesus, and what does that happens then? Is that the church is destroyed, and so that's the three great earthquakes: the establishment of the church, and then we go and see the rise to power, and then we see a attitudinal correction. A power correction in the next great earthquake in the French Revolution. And so the star of the church starts to wane. And then we've got it being destroyed later by Jesus. And so those are the three great earthquakes. Right, so now I do want to get to a particular point. And so I can provide these references later and we can have a look at them. We might look at some of them. So we've got the heavens and the earth, and what we understand is that the heavens are the ruling powers and the earth is people, all right? So that's a generally accepted and well-known division of what that means, all right? So you've got an Isaiah where the earth is like a troubled sea and it casts up its mire. And that's a sea of nations. That didn't help. That's the wrong reference. Let's go to reference. All right, so let's go to Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 1 and at verse 2. Okay, so we've got it, verse 1. The vision of Isaiah, the son of Amos, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord hath spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. So he's addressing the heavens and the earth. So is he really addressing the physical heaven and the physical earth? What good would that be? I don't think so. But if you have a look in verse 10, so verse 1 again, hear, for the Lord has spoken. Right? So they need to hear the word, but in verse 10 of Isaiah chapter 1, hear the word of the Lord, ye rulers of Sodom. All right? So that's the heavens. And give ear unto the law of our God, ye people of Gomorrah. Right? So that's the earth. So it's a very simple quotation to go and establish that. Right? So you've got the heaven and the earth. Right? Then we've got the sun, moon, and the stars. And so can anybody think of an occasion in Scripture, and it's another vision, or it's actually a dream, where the sun, moon, and stars are mentioned?
Joseph.
Joseph, right? And what does Joseph's dad say when the sun, moon, and stars bow down to Joseph? Shall I and your mother and your brothers, right? So there's a spiritual, we can translate this and we can apply it. And so the sun, what that stands for is a political rulership. The moon, right? So if we just have a think about it logically, why do we see the moon? Because it gets the light from the sun. And so in these times, what is happening is that the authority of the church comes from the political power. So the moon is lit, the religious moon is given light and power by the political sun, right? So the moon is a religious rulership. And then the stars, well, those are the rulers, and the 12 sons of Jacob become the 12 tribes, so they're the rulers of the people, right? So that's the sun, moon, and the stars, all right? So sun, moon, and stars. But what happens to them? Well, the sun, it becomes black. So if the sun is black, well, you can't see it anymore. And so the radiance and the power of the sun is taken away. And so in this instance, the political power of the sun is taken away. The moon becomes as blood. Right? So the moon is bleeding. Okay? It's getting damaged. And ultimately, if you bleed too much, what happens? You die. Right, so the moon is getting damaged. The religion and the religious power that day, which was paganism, don't forget that's the church that we're talking about, the church of paganism, that goes and starts bleeding. All right, and then what about the stars? Well, they fall to the earth. And so the nobility, those who are important in the Roman structure in those days, they're going to start to fall. And that's what we're looking for. In terms of what happens in history, we're looking for an earthquake. So this is monumental. There is going to be a monumental shift in things, in the sun, in politics, in the moon, in religion, and in the stars, in the upper classes and the rulership, those have the rule over the commoners. And so how's this going to be accomplished? We start getting a clue, because what we've got in the verse, as it's highlighted over there, they are shaken of a mighty wind. And in Jeremiah and chapter 4, that wind is a military. There's something that's going to happen that's going to involve military action. So we're going to be seeing some violence and some bloodshed and some battles. And what's the result of this? What's the result of this? Well, the heavens are going to depart as a scroll when it is wrapped up together, right? When it is rolled together. And so that's where this artist's impression is so good, because the heavens, the day and the night, so we've got the sun over there, that's black, it's turned to black, the moon is turned to blood, the stars are falling from heaven, and the whole heaven and earth is just being rolled up like a scroll. It's being rolled together like a scroll. So a very dramatic time that's going to be happening on the earth and in the Roman Empire. All right? And what is the extent of this? How big is this change going to be? It's going to affect everybody. It's going to affect everybody. All right? Kings of the earth, great men, rich men, chief captains, mighty men, every bondman, every free man, even down to the slave and the free person, is going to be affected by this change. So monumental it was going to be. So, let's start having a look at what happens. So let's have a look, just a look, a quick initial look at the events of the sixth seal. And key to the sixth seal is this man, Constantine the First, Constantine the Great, as he's called. So, just as an aside, so that statue, that head, comes from something called the Colossus of Constantine. It's a statue called the Colossus of Constantine, a very, meek and mild man who didn't really, want to go and push himself too far. Not. So, has anybody been there and stood there? Okay, so you know how tall that is? It's about 5 meters tall. Abraham Lincoln sitting down is 5 meters tall. All right, so for those who haven't been there and know our family, so there's Jonathan and Timothy and Noni standing there. So that gives an idea of the scale. Okay, so Jonathan's over, in old language, 6 foot. So it's quite immense. The Colossus of Constantine, so that's 5 meters tall. The Colossus of Constantine was 12 meters tall. So it was more than double the height of it. So it was an immense statue. Okay, so what do we already know about Constantine? Okay, so we know that he's a son of a Caesar, and who becomes an Augustine, and he's the son of Constantius and Helena. All right, we know that Helena's divorced, and Helena and Constantine go and live in Nicomedia with Diocletian. We've seen how that he's spurned by Galerius in favor of Maximinus Daa. He rushes across to go and join his dad in York, and on death he is proclaimed the Augustus by his troops, and he's the title of Caesar is bestowed. Okay, so remember this. But wait, there's more. Well, here's more. Right, so what happens next? Okay, and here comes a bit of a merry-go-round as to who's where and all of that. So this is the situation. So by suicide, Flavius Severus is removed, and Maxentius goes and pushes himself up, and so he's sitting alongside, effectively sitting alongside Constantine. Okay, now Galerius doesn't really like this at all. Okay, so he doesn't really like this at all. So what happens about the, just to go and complete something, what happens about the Caesars? Well, there are Caesars appointed, but they are not important, and they have a very short lifespan. So, off they go. So Galerius is actually quite annoyed by what happens with Maxentius, and so he doesn't want that to happen. And so what he does is he appoints an Augustus called Licinius as the Augustus of the Western Empire. So it's getting a bit crowded up there, isn't it? Okay, it's getting a bit crowded. Okay, now, so we've already established what happens to Galerius towards the end of the fifth seal, is that he dies. And then what happens in theory is, well, what does actually happen is Maximinus Daa then goes and becomes the Eastern, the empire, the Augustus of the Eastern region of the empire. But things don't go too well between Maximinus Daa and Licinius. All right, so they really take a set against each other. Again, in this one, the Caesars aren't that important on this side. So they take a set against each other, and, well, there's a war. And this is starting in the just about the time of the changeover from the 5th to the 6th seal. And so Maximinus Daa, he's demoted, but ends up having to either being murdered or being forced to commit suicide by Licinius. And Licinius becomes the emperor, the ruler, the Augustus of the Eastern region. And so when we get the important rulers, when we get the commencement of the sixth seal, which commences in AD 312, the important rulers of the day are Constantine, who's over in England and over France. And then we have Maxentius, and he's over Italy and North Africa and Spain. And then we have Licinius, who's over the eastern part of the empire. So this tetrarchy, the rule of four, has now become rule of three. So the tetrarchy is gone. Now, what are we expecting to see? Well, remember, we've got a mighty wind. And so there's military. We're expecting to see military campaigns. And this starts in 312 with Constantine. So he's over here in York. in England, and so he comes across to France, and they go to he gets to a place called Turin, and he has a battle against Maxentius, and he wins. And then it goes he goes along to Verona, has another battle with Maxentius, and he wins. And Maxentius is retreating. Eventually goes back to Rome. And so there's another battle at Rome, and I'm sure many of us have heard of Milvain Bridge, the Battle of Milvain Bridge, and he wins that too. But what Milvain Bridge, the Battle of Milvain Bridge, is very well known for is a dream that Constantine is alleged to have, right, where he sees the Chi Rho, the sign of a cross, and he says, he calls all his troops together, and what you've got in the back over there, that little bridge over there, that's Milvain Bridge, right? He calls all his troops together, and he says, conquer in this sign, the sign of the cross. So quite a dramatic turn of events, the first time that the Roman army is fighting under the banner so-called Christianity. But it wasn't as if this was his Damascus Road moment. Okay, the artist has quite cleverly gone and left a few hangers-on. All right, so we've got Invictus Sol over here, the sun god. All right, we've got a bird here, which is a symbol of another god, and we've got a dragon here as well. So Constantine wasn't a Christian from the get-go. We know he was only baptized 3 days before his death, but he's still hanging on. In fact, when he goes and is victorious, he actually goes into a pagan temple and offers his offering. So he gives thanks to a pagan god after telling his troops, conquer in this sign. So he's a bit duplicitous in this. And there we have Milvain Bridge. And so Maxentius is in Rome. Milvain Bridge is on the outskirts, just in front of the walls of Rome. Constantine troops gather there, and they're actually outnumbered. Maxentius and his troops decide right now they're wanting Constantine to come across the bridge. That doesn't happen. So Maxentius and his troops start to advance across the bridge, and Constantine's cavalry charges across the bridge, and they are pushing people back. And what happens is that all these queue of people going up, and they get pushed together. And so where you had a whole lot of people in heavy armor standing this far apart, now you've got them not observing social distancing and being really close together. And so you've got a concentration of weight, and the bridge collapses. And so a whole lot of Maxentius's soldiers fall into the river in their heavy armor and are drowned. A whole lot of Maxentius's soldiers and Maxentius himself. He drowns in the river. And so what does Constantine do? He goes and fishes the body of Maxentius out, chops off his head, sticks it in the pole, and goes and parades into Rome as the victor. So very emphatic victory over Maxentius. And so from the emperors, he drowns, and in case he wasn't dead from drowning, he gets his head chopped off. And so now Constantine is ruling over half the Roman Empire, and there's Licinius left. But that is a story for next week. So we'll leave it there. Next time. 2 weeks' time.